By the late 1970s, roughly 60% of the world's population found itself under socialist governments of one kind or another. Communists ruled China, Russia, Eastern Europe, and much of Asia. Third world socialist governments controlled three nations in the Middle East and Africa. Social democratic parties held majorities in much of Western Europe. Even with all its problems, socialism was still in power. Then, unexpectedly, the pendulum began to swing.
In 1968, the influential American sociologist Michael Harrington could convincingly write these words: most of the people around the world call the name of their dream socialism. Despite all the carnage wrought in its name, the idea of socialism somehow retained great power over the human imagination. But even then, socialism's grip on power was coming to an end. Hello, I'm Ben Wattenberg. Welcome to the concluding episode of Heaven on Earth, a think tank special. In this hour, the two great communist powers move away from socialism with momentous consequences. In the West, in order to stay in business, democratic socialists relabel themselves the Party of Business. And among the kibbutzim of Israel, the socialist faithful are tested by modernity, prosperity, and generational change. We begin in China.
In December 1978, the Chinese Communist Party yielded to vision of a new leader, Deng Xiaoping. Deng's plan for China after Mao began with what he called the four modernizations of agriculture, industry, technology, and defense.
What was different about Deng Xiaoping is that he was not ideological. He didn't believe you could introduce utopia overnight, as Mao thought he could do. And he realized that in order to bring about change in China, you had to have fundamental economic reforms.
Change lay ahead for the social democratic world as well. The following spring, Margaret Thatcher became the first female prime minister of Britain. Central to a campaign, a promise to reverse the legacy of Clement Attlee. She began by privatizing many of the nationalized industries.
Margaret Thatcher's election in 1979 really is an emblem of the first triumphs of the capitalist revolution. A year later, Ronald Reagan comes to office. Soon after that, socialist regimes in France and Spain make definite rightward turns. So while it would be too much to see Margaret Thatcher's election as the beginning of the end, it is a very powerful first salvo and an augur of things to come.
What I'm describing now is a plan and a hope for the long term. The march of freedom and democracy, which will leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history as it has left other tyrannies which stifle the freedom and muzzle the self-expression of the people.
The accession to power of Ronald Reagan, which happened to come at around the same time as the shift to the right in other comparable societies, all of them had in common, not just Reagan but also Thatcher, the view that Soviet power, the apparently unshakable edifice of the USSR and its Eastern European dependencies, needn't be taken for granted, that its survival was not a given. Why assume that they're going to be our rivals forever? Why not see if we can outbid them and even subvert them?
As Reagan took office, signs of strain were beginning to appear in the Soviet Empire.
In the summer of 1980, Polish workers defied the communist government by going on strike in the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk. The strike grew into an independent trade union committed to democracy, Solidarity. Soon it could count more than one out of every four Poles as members.
The advent of Solidarity in Poland was one of the most significant factors that contributed to the collapse of communism. First, by example, the fact that Solidarity, an independent trade union, could come into existence in a workers' state where workers were allegedly happy, showed, first of all, that they weren't happy, and second of all, that change was possible, and it was without question a great inspiration to the dissident movements across the bloc.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin faced a crisis in leadership. In March of 1985, Soviet leaders gathered in Red Square for the funeral of Konstantin Chernyanko, the third Soviet leader to die in office in the past 2 years. Their choice for a new leader was fateful. Mikhail Gorbachev may have been the last true believer in the revolution's ideals. But his attempt to recover true socialism from the communist bureaucracy would shake the Soviet Union to its foundations. Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev grew up in the 1930s. It was a period known as the Great Terror. Under the rule of Lenin's successor, Joseph Stalin, millions were arrested and often executed. Scholars say that as many as 20 million people died.
Gorbachev was the grandson of a rich peasant who was arrested, deported. These were called kulaks. And in the early 1930s, the kulaks were all told to go to work on collective farms, and those who disagreed were deported, killed, sent to concentration camps. His other grandfather was arrested in the 1930s, was also in a camp. So he grew up with a very powerful sense of what had been wrong with the system, of what had really happened during Stalin's time, and this probably did have an effect on his later politics.
By the time Gorbachev became General Secretary in 1985, he realized the Soviet system was not only cruel, it was hopelessly inefficient.
Imagine what it is getting an American driving license. It's quite difficult, quite a tedious process. Imagine doing it every day. This is what the Soviet life was. The whole system was based on people, as we said, pretending that they work, and the government pretending that it pays. It used more people where you could have used more brains, and that, I think, ineffectiveness, this swampish feeling of absolutely going nowhere, that was what Gorbachev inherited.
But for Gorbachev, the problem was not with the Soviet system itself. It was with how that system was being run.
One-party state socialism was, according to Gorbachev, a voluntary free choice of the Russian people. He felt that, therefore, he could loosen up the controls, but basically that would not change one thing that was the most important to him, which is the state ownership of the economy, which to him was the basis of the Soviet regime.
Gorbachev had a core diagnosis for what ailed the Soviet economy: bureaucracy. His prescription to fight it was called perestroika.
In a way, perestroika means rebuilding, transforming things. But I think that Gorbachev still considered it possible that all these things would be done within this centrally planned system that existed in the Soviet Union. That was his mistake.
Gorbachev set out to cut the red tape. But the whole system was made of red tape. For all his efforts, it seemed Gorbachev was running in place.
Soviet
As Gorbachev struggled to clear a path to true socialism in the Soviet Union, the socialist idea was being redefined in China. Deng Xiaoping said his reforms were creating socialism with Chinese characteristics. Many observers thought it looked more like capitalism. Whatever it was changing the face of China. The country had just emerged from one of the most devastating periods in its history. After the failure of the Great Leap Forward, Mao Zedong launched the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. The goal was to cleanse the country of creeping capitalist and bourgeois influence. But Mao's new revolution soon veered out of control. Over the next decade, some 100 million Chinese citizens were persecuted, including Communist Party officials.
What Mao did was use the young people, he called the Red Guards, to literally throw out the party leader, to rebel against their teachers, rebel against anyone with any position or any seniority. And so it was led to a period of utter chaos in China, in the economy, in the political system. And it was that chaos that totally, I believe, demoralized the population, turned them away not only from Mao, but from any belief that Marxism, Leninism, or any ideology, or any ideological utopia was going to solve their problems.
Deng Xiaoping had been with the communist movement from the beginning and served as one of Mao's closest advisors. But his pragmatic outlook had more than once landed him in trouble. During the Cultural Revolution, he was twice purged from power. Deng's family fared worse. The Red Guards drove his brother to suicide and his oldest son to jump out of a window, sustaining injuries that left him a paraplegic. But Deng's fortunes would soon change. Mao's death in 1976 gave rise to a vicious power struggle, and Deng came out on top.
When Mao died, Deng was the highest ranking leader left. Several leaders died during the Cultural Revolution, and he came back to power with a few of his old communist buddies who supported him, who were totally disillusioned with Maoist policies, and they were open. They didn't know what they wanted to do. In fact, the slogan they used was, "We have to feel for the stones as we cross the river to get to the other side."
In 1978, 18 families in China's Anhui province made a secret pact. They would divide their collective farm into individual plots. They would work independently, and each family could keep whatever profits they earned. If any of them got arrested, the others promised to care for their children.
When Deng heard about this from one of his colleagues, who was the governor of the province of Anhui where it began, he said, "Don't stop that." He says, "Let's see how it works out." And when this governor then reported that incomes were increasing and harvests were doubling, then Deng said, "Okay, this is the way to go." And so he made this a policy by the early 1980s, by 1982. This was the policy in the whole country. Every single commune was decollectivized.
Deng Xiaoping had a saying that had infuriated Mao: "It doesn't matter if the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice."
Peasants got back their own family plots, and that released this energy of the peasants to earn money. They had economic incentives, and then the villages began to set up small workshops, and they did small-scale things. Then they began to make connections with the international markets, and they would start producing shirts or socks or textile goods. So it was a gradual process.
When I first started as a freshman in college in 1978, our meals did not even have enough meat. By my second year in college, things began to change dramatically. Food became abundant, a variety of vegetables, meat became available. And I feel at that time I could see the change quite dramatically unfolding. And indeed, people knew that's because the reform.
1984 marked the 35th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. According to the World Bank, China's economic growth had now reached 10% per year. It would remain there for more than a decade. But China was still a communist country. Beneath the rising tide of economic and personal freedom, the political system remained largely unchanged.
In the beginning, Deng Xiaoping thought he could have both economic reform and also political reform. But when the Solidarity Movement developed in Poland, there was this great fear in the Chinese leadership that you would have a comparable development in China, joining together of labor, of workers, and intellectuals. So he began to gradually clamp down.
On May 15, 1989, the Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev boarded a jetliner for Beijing. His historic visit would lay to rest a bitter 30-year struggle for leadership of the communist world. An elaborate welcoming ceremony was planned at Beijing's Great Hall of the People. But there was a problem.
Suddenly a message comes to Gorbachev or his party on the airplane saying, well, we've changed the plans. When you land, we're going to have some alternative ceremony. We're not going to the Great Hall of the People. And the reason is because that's in Tiananmen Square, and Tiananmen Square is filled with demonstrators demanding an end to communist rule in China.
By the third day of Gorbachev's visit, a million people occupy the square and the surrounding area. Once the Soviet leader had departed, Deng ordered his troops to clear the square.
To this day, we do not know exact numbers of people who died in the bloodshed. Some reports say there were thousands, others say hundreds, probably truth is somewhere in between.
Even though Deng had put down the movement for political reform in China, he soon ordered that economic reform resume. In 1993, the National People's Congress enshrined the term socialist market economy in the Constitution. Still, the Communist Party remained firmly in control.
Deng is a very complex figure. His stature in history will be examined, re-examined many, many times down the road. His end goal is not to dismantle the rule of the Chinese Communist Party. Never was. The Chinese reform, it was able to keep stability, but it has not really fundamentally changed the political system.
Deng and Gorbachev were two reformers who set out to rescue socialism. But they were on two different paths. While Deng focused on overhauling the economy, Gorbachev turned his attention to the political system.
Gorbachev in 1987 did face a choice. He came to the point where he either had to retreat to essentially neo-Stalinism of the Brezhnev era and pray that there would be enough political stability for him to serve out his term, or he had to radicalize his approach. Nobody at the time, say early 1987, had any idea that this would lead to a revolution.
In a way, it had come full circle. Here, Lenin had revised Marx, Karl Marx, who believed that the proletariat was naturally socialistic and would make a revolution, and Lenin, who had a politics based on the absence of trust. And now Gorbachev flips and is completely the opposite from Lenin, and saying that we have to trust the people, otherwise we have no socialism and we have no Soviet regime.
Gorbachev now spoke often about glasnost, a word that meant openness. The Soviet people were now free to talk about subjects that had long been forbidden. The nation soon found itself awash in a flood of revelations about the crimes of Joseph Stalin. But glasnost didn't stop there.
Contrary to what Gorbachev expected, they quickly disposed with Stalinism. They started talking. They went back all the way to Lenin, who to Gorbachev at that time was an icon. And they quickly began to discover how unjust, how inequitable, how stupid economically the entire regime was. It was no longer Stalinism that was to blame. It's the entire system of one-party dictatorship based on the total ownership of economy by the state. Glasnost became a match, a burning match thrown in the pool of gasoline, and that's required was just giving it enough time to burn it.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Under pressure from both within and without, the momentum of change accelerated.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
In March 1989, the Soviet Union held the first free parliamentary elections in its history.
A lot of communist bigwigs were just sort of kicked out. And some young faces, you know, engineers, doctors, philosophers, journalists, suddenly became MPs, members of parliament.
But 1989 had only gotten started. Poland was the first domino to fall. Solidarity, the independent trade union, had managed to survive underground through the 1980s. Faced with rising discontent, the Polish communists finally gave in to demands for parliamentary elections.
There were free elections held, but there was a trick, which was there were certain seats that were supposed to be guaranteed for the government, which the opposition was not allowed to run against. And yet, it may be the only time in history that candidates ran unopposed and still lost.
Voters simply crossed the communists' names off the ballot. Meanwhile, Solidarity had captured 99 out of 100 seats in the new Senate. All the while, Moscow stood by in silence.
The Polish events had a huge effect on the Soviet Union. To see people like us doing something completely different, just standing up and opposing, that was something people couldn't believe. We couldn't believe it was happening on our doorstep. And in this respect, the victory of Solidarity-led coalition in parliamentary elections in June 1989 was something that started the final stage of the collapse of the what was called the Eastern Bloc. Next year, the Warsaw Pact was gone.
Magyar Köztársaság!
Köszönjük, Many of the Soviet republics began to assert their independence, while Gorbachev struggled to lay the groundwork for a post-Soviet Union of sovereign states. But a group of hardline communist aides had had enough. In August 1991, they launched a coup and placed Gorbachev under house arrest. Tanks and troops appeared on the streets of Moscow. At the time, Konstantin Eggert was a newspaper reporter in Moscow.
Well, I rushed off to my editorial office in a city newspaper, and it was this feeling of, oh yeah, we know, here they come. We know what they're going to do. They're not going to spare anyone.
Then something remarkable happened. Hundreds of thousands of citizens poured the streets to resist. Many of the soldiers joined them.
When it really went, not with a bang, but with a whimper. Nothing happened. Just all these mighty armies, KGB, all those people held sway over the country for 70 years. They just hid. Just ran away. There was nobody to defend it. It was a system without defenders.
In the middle of it all was Boris Yeltsin, the newly elected president of the Russian Federation. His popularity had now eclipsed Gorbachev's. After the coup collapsed, it was Yeltsin who issued a decree that effectively outlawed the Communist Party. In the following months, the Russian republics voted one by one to declare their independence. On Christmas Day, 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as leader of the disintegrating Soviet Union. The once fearsome communist power was no more.
When I think about the fate of socialism, and when I think about the fate of socialism in other countries where it still supposedly exists, for example, China, I always remember this 1980s experience in Russia. You go to a small corner, very quiet, and whisper there, freedom. And suddenly it echoes all over the place, freedom, 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 and you can't stop it. It's like an avalanche. That's my impression of this era.
With the fall of the Soviet Union, the era of totalitarian socialism effectively came to a close. But did the collapse of communism mean the end of socialism?
The fall of communism at the end of the 1980s, celebrated at the time as a great victory for the right and for capitalism and for a defeat for socialism, actually, I believe, for socialism in the West, was a huge liberating moment. Because from that time, you were free of that contamination. You were free of that guilt by association. You had to be taken on your own terms. And that deprived the right of a major chunk of its armory.
Social democratic parties were making a comeback across Europe. By the late 1990s, they governed 12 of the 15 states in the European Union. But many of these parties looked less and less like the socialists of the past.
I do hereby declare that Anthony Charles Linton Blair has been duly elected.
The most daring revisionist was Briton Tony Blair, who led the Labour Party to victory in 1997 with a landslide vote. The party as Blair recreated it is a far cry from the party of Attlee.
We all said that if we had the courage to change, then we could do it, and we did it.
What we wanted more than anything else was to be back in government, and it seemed that Tony Blair would do that by making what amounted to a clean start. Many Labour Party people did not realise how much of social democracy he intended to abandon.
Tony Blair was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and spent most of his childhood in northern England. His father was active in politics, starting as a communist and ending up as a conservative. A one-time frontman for a band called The Ugly Rumors, Tony himself came to politics only at the end of his college years.
He was a rebel, but he was quite a careful rebel. But there was also a much quieter side to him. I mean, he became a confirmed Christian at Oxford University, with a passionate belief in social justice and left-wing political values.
Blair won his first parliament seat in 1983. He was just 30 years old. But he was bucking the national tide.
Margaret Hilda Thatcher, Conservative Party...
Labour's fortunes were near the lowest point ever.
616.
And the party ticket was trounced by the Conservatives.
There was this sense that the different traditions that made up the Labour Party had been tried, failed, and that tradition therefore exhausted itself. So people like Blair, in a sense, had reason to think that they should remake the party from top to bottom.
57%. In 1994, Labour leader John Smith died of a heart attack.
I therefore declare that Tony Blair is elected leader of Labour.
The party turned to Blair.
This man, our new leader, has got what it takes. He commands moral authority and political respect. He has the energy and vitality to win people over to Labour. And he scares the life out of the Tories. And me.
Oh, this is a very exciting time. And it was a crusading sort of zeal to him and the key advisors around him, which was very exciting, but it was also worrying at times in terms of his ability to take the party with him at all times. I think that was best captured by the day that Tony Blair somewhat delphically announced at the Labour Party conference that he was prepared to embark on a review of the Constitution, or as he called it, our aims and values.
Let us say what we mean and mean what we say. Stop saying what we don't mean and start saying what we do mean, what we stand by, what we stand for.
The words may have been cryptic, but everyone in the Labour Party knew what Blair was talking about. Clause 4, the part of the Labour Party's charter that committed it to common ownership. Blair wanted to make clear to voters that the party no longer believed in this kind of socialism.
It is not the socialism of Marx or state control. We are the party of the individual because we are the party of community. It is socialism.
But Clause 4 had been around since 1918, and many in the Labour Party were not willing to give it up without a fight.
Clause 4 is a totemic thing. It's an icon. And people don't like those things being fiddled around with. It's like trying to change the prayer book in the Church of England. It causes all kinds of controversy.
The following year, Labour delegates gathered at Methodist Central Hall in Westminster, where the original Clause 4 was adopted 77 years before, to vote on Blair's new language.
For the new Clause 4, 65.23% against 34%.
65% were in favor.
When Blair convinced the party to do away with the traditional socialist language of Clause 4, what was in its place was pure double talk, and you can read it over and over again without figuring out exactly what it's saying. But the meaning of that double talk became clear in action when Blair then started running for prime minister and leading the Labour Party in a new campaign, and the policies that he was advocating in the campaign were anything but socialist policies.
Now, what do you think, then, the relationship should be between the trade union and the Labour government?
Fairness, not favours. We're also putting forward proposals as to how we can involve the private sector as well as the public sector. It is a welfare-to-work budget.
What seemed to be essential for Tony Blair and New Labour was to create the impression of being a safe pair of hands. And the approach really boils down to several things. First, distancing the Labour Party from the trade unions. Second, appealing to middle-class swing voters who otherwise were voting Conservatives. And finally, and most generally, making peace with the business world, with the British markets and with capitalism.
Even those business people that aren't supporting Labour now know they've got a Labour Party that supports enterprise, that supports business.
As the 1997 general election approached, Blair's strategy seemed to be working. By the evening of May the 2nd, 1997, the votes had been counted. Labour rolled to its largest win ever, even topping Attlee's record victory in 1945.
All over this country, there were people that were crying out for a sensible, mainstream, moderate alternative to the Conservative Party.
Today, enough of talking. It is time now to do. Thank you.
Blair easily won re-election in 2001. But his policies led many to wonder whether the Labour Party was still a socialist party.
Yeah, the Labour Party is a socialist party. The only problem is these days we're not so sure what socialism is. It's a socialist party in the sense that it stands for a conception of society and community and people owing obligations to each other, and stands for what I said was that core belief about giving everybody in society access to things that that society can offer. That, I think, is the core idea. And I think if you look at many of the programs that we're engaged in, you can still define them by that core idea.
The Prime Minister would say that New Labour was a redefinition of socialism. I believe it's a rejection of socialism. I believe that many things in the Labour Party's policy needed to change to meet the demands of the modern world. But I thought we ought to hold tight to our basic principles and see how those basic principles could be applied in the modern world. The Prime Minister has abandoned the basic principles.
Socialist or not, Blair's approach was catching on. Eventually, as many as 14 social democratic heads of state from Europe, South Africa, and New Zealand embraced similar policies. As they talked about the importance of inclusion and a social safety net, they increasingly acknowledged the necessity for capitalism. The triumph of free enterprise was the theme at the first annual Capitalist Ball in Brussels. Revelers from around the world gathered on the floor of the Belgian Stock Exchange to celebrate capitalism. The day before the ball, some of the people here got together to look at the future of socialism.
Ladies and gentlemen, comrades, you're the wrong audience for that.
The conclusion was anything but an obituary.
Socialism will not die, but it will surely change into something else.
And I would argue that today socialism, after the failed experiment of the Soviet Union, has gone back to some of its 9th century features as an anti-establishment.
I don't believe that socialism is dead because I don't believe that the impulse which drives people towards the left, the desire to control, meddle and interfere in other people's lives, can ever die.
Liberty is always under threat, and socialism is one of those threats. And yet there's something dynamic and moral in the heart of socialism as well. It's that ambiguity that keeps the thing alive, and it makes it always a danger.
At the 21st Annual Socialist Scholars Conference in New York City, a very different view prevailed.
We think that the break of the Soviet Union and the fall of the wall affected all the left. Social Democrats, because they lose some reference to build some model of regulation.
You don't go from what you've got to what you desire like that. You have to win a series of changes.
It's a mistake to equate the failure of particular socialist parties and regimes with the failure of socialism or the end of socialist values or vision. They're a reflection of the fact that they were trying to build institutions at a certain point of time in a certain part of the world. And it was to be expected, given the dynamism and power of capitalism as a system, that the first attempts to build institutions overthrow it would not be the perfect ones. And I'm sure that we'll see over the course of the next century loads of attempts to build new ones, new parties, new unions, new movements that will be socialist in their fundamental essence, that will learn from the mistakes of the past.
A non-reformist reform is to fight for these kinds of changes and many others in a manner which leaves us, when we win, not going home, but desiring more.
Many at the conference said the anti-globalization and anti-war movements may hold the seeds of socialism's future. But some believe the idea might not always go by the same name.
A lot of people, when they hear that label, they immediately reject it. Oh, socialism, I've been taught that that's wrong. So I don't necessarily feel the need to use that label. I mean, I like the term economic democracy. I think that's a fantastic term, because I think that's the way people can start to think about it. We need to start extending democracy to the sphere of economics.
Here and elsewhere, there seem to be no shortage of arguments that socialist ideas can still play a vital role in politics.
If you look at what some of the market ideologues were saying at the time the war came down, at the end of the 1980s, when their victory dances were so exaggerated, that they were very much, seemed to me, like the Marxists of old, who thought they had sort of cracked the secret of history. But of course you don't crack the secret of history, because you find it throws up new problems for you. The market won in that sense, insofar as there was no organized alternative to it. It hadn't won in the sense that the choice had not been removed as to whether you want a market economy or whether you want to extend that into a market society.
Social democracy has always been characterized by its belief that markets have an important economic function, but its distaste for their impact on social and political outcomes. This is what differentiates social democrats from Marxists, from communists, and this sense, or this desire, to use the market to harness the most powerful economic mechanism available, but to not allow it to kind of determine what happens in the political or social sphere. This is still an idea or a vision that has immense appeal and is still very relevant to the 21st century.
The new century begins. Social democratic parties govern most of Europe. But the policies they offer bear little resemblance to the heady dreams of their socialist forebears. Amid electoral politics, the quest to remake human nature and create a heaven on earth has all but been abandoned.
It turns out that social democracy, or democratic socialism, is a contradiction in terms. In many cases, socialist parties have gotten it into power, like Mitterrand France, like Attlee in England, like German Social Democrats, and set about trying to march step by step to socialism. In every single case, after a certain number of years, they've reversed course. For all the socialist parties we've had in scores of countries around the world, there's not been one case in which a free electorate has wanted to continue a march all the way to socialism. They've always taken a few steps that way and then wanted to pull back.
The farthest socialism ever advanced democratically was in Israel's kibbutzim. For years, the kibbutzim had been tiptoeing away from a completely communal way of life. But basic socialist principles still held. Members contributed what they could, and the kibbutz provided for their needs. Now, though, communities like Ginosar are undergoing a transformation so complete, many wonder they can still call themselves kibbutzim.
The first generation followed in our footsteps. The second generation, less. And the third generation, the ones who now are running the kibbutz, they're completely different.
It all began in the late 1970s, when Israel's labor government fell to the conservatives, and the kibbutzim lost much of the financial support that had sustained them. When a debt crisis hit Israel in 1985, the kibbutzim found themselves holding loans they could not pay back.
Until 1985, the kibbutz member could always say to himself, well, there are problems, we're not so sure about whether our way of life is better than the way the rest of the world lives, but it works. After this, after the economic crisis hit, they couldn't say that anymore.
By the late 1970s and early 1980s, the first children born on the kibbutzim had grown up and had children and grandchildren of their own. Now that the urgent task of building a nation had passed, the younger generations were becoming disillusioned with life on the kibbutz.
The kibbutzniks shared with other socialists the idea that people were a product of their socialization, and that if you brought people up in a system of complete justice, you could create a new man, that is, someone who was devoid of selfish individualism and who would really think and live for the welfare of the group as a whole. And it turns out to be exactly the opposite.
The kibbutz children grew up into intelligent, enterprising, hard-working, constructive individuals, but they did not grow up as socialists.
We lived a very austere life, the most one could, and this didn't appeal to the children. As long as they lived within the warm confines of the kibbutz, they didn't see what went on outside. The moment they saw there was something completely different, in the army and elsewhere, that's when the problem started with people leaving.
Moshe Abbas's daughter Noah was one of those who considered leaving.
I think the kibbutz is generally not natural. It goes completely against nature. It's the complete opposite of human nature. Because you work very hard and give everything you've got, you work at several jobs, and in return you get the same as someone who doesn't work.
To keep skilled workers, Ginosar and other kibbutzim began paying salaries based not on need, but on market value. They even began to hire foreign labor for the lowest paying jobs.
They brought in advisors from the outside that said, well, I was looking after the kibbutz gardens is worth this and this per month. The teacher in the school is worth so much, and the childcare worker in the kindergarten is worth this much. And everyone got their own wage. That, to my mind, is the crucial change in the kibbutz. When the principle of from each according to his ability to each according to his needs was changed and people got what they earned.
Today, Ginosar has joined most of the rest of the world in embracing capitalism. And like three-quarters of the kibbutzim, it is working toward turning over ownership of housing to individual members. The kibbutzniks will become homeowners.
I think those who stayed, stayed thanks to the changes. If changes hadn't been made, I wouldn't be here either. And thanks to the changes, we saved every penny. As a school principal, and my husband who works at two jobs, we managed to get our own private car. 2 weeks ago, at the age of almost 43, I have a car. I have independence, And this change for me is excellent. It became worthwhile to work. In the past, we used to work because of values, and now there are new values. The supreme value, we are ordinary human beings after all, is money, and quality of living, and the promise to our children that they will get something.
All these changes have led many to wonder if the kibbutzim are on their way to becoming little more than suburbs with a socialist heritage.
There was no chance that we could continue this kind of lifestyle, which is found nowhere else in the world. Nowhere else where people of their own free will would live for years and years in such a communal and collective way. The country doesn't need us anymore. This thing, this way of life, has reached its end. It has spent itself. As far as reason goes, the kibbutz must come to an end.
The kibbutzim were the one place or group of places on earth where real, pure socialism, just as it was imagined by all the great socialist visionaries, was actually put into practice and put into practice democratically. And the ironic ending was that the same people, after a certain number of years, democratically voted to turn away from socialism and to put the kibbutz in some other basis. And I think that constitutes the final proof that socialism, except coerced as in China or Russia, but socialism as a voluntary way for societies to live is simply an impossibility, that people ultimately won't be satisfied living that way.
As you might imagine, I am not a socialist, although I applaud some of the reforms that socialists brought our way. But as I think about socialism, my thoughts keep returning to America. At the same time the socialist faith was beginning to take shape on the European continent, a group of former British colonists were also building a new society, but they had something different in mind. America's founders tailored our system to people as they are, not as they should be in some ideal world in the future. And that system has seen socialism's rise and now its decline. Democratic capitalism is not perfect, but it works as well as anything we've seen. For those who want to improve the world, it's something to keep in mind. Thank you for watching. For Think Tank, I'm Ben Wattenberg.